Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. This is a podcast run by artists for artists where we talk about what it means to be one. I'm Tun Mian, the producer, with our host Dina Brodsky and Marshall Jones. This is being recorded between our many jobs and side hustles. We bring you in-depth investigations into the lives of artists we admire and the stories behind the creative journey. So stay on the grind while we fill your mind.
Hi everyone. So before we get started today, I'd like to say a big thank you to the Professional Artists Institute for sponsoring this episode of Art Grind. Their mission is to help artists make a living from their work and basically survive and thrive as an artist so that we don't all have to work multiple jobs in order to support our passion. So if you're anything like me and prefer to spend time in your studio making art rather than marketing your work and kind of concentrating on the business side of things, then check out some of their free trainings at professionalartist.com-free and get a free training on how to get your next art collector. I promise that you will like it and it will help because it helps me. All right, bye everyone, enjoy the episode.
So hello everyone, Marshall and Dina here. Today we talk to Christopher Jobson, founder of Colossal, which is a online publication art curatorial entity. Right, Dina?
It's an online art publication with a huge audience that has brought a lot of amazing art to my attention, along with other people.
And you guys who know me, that I'm the most offline person around, I don't know much about, you know, these type of things, but he was great to talk to and gave me a much better feeling about the online space and where it's headed for art, for sure.
All right. So just as some spoilers, we're going to be getting into a discussion about AI, which we've probably been avoiding doing for the last few months when everyone else was talking about AI. And Christopher is going to be announcing a few projects that he hasn't actually announced anywhere. So there's a few top secret things that are going to be coming to light by the end of this episode.
Yeah. And Colossal, no pun intended, is massive. It's colossal. It has a ton of readers and subscribers, and they're definitely have a big footprint on the art world. And I found it very, inspiring, hopeful that someone behind it has so much integrity as Christopher does. And it feels like there are some good entities out there that aren't just algorithmic overlords for us.
We do get into the algorithmic overlords quite a bit. Hope you guys like it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Art Grind Podcast. I'm Marshall Jones here with Dina Brodsky.
Our special guest today is Christopher Jobson. So Christopher is many things, but he's the founder and mastermind behind Colossal, one of my favorite online art publications. And he's a curator and he always has a ton of really, really cool projects going. So yeah, welcome, Christopher.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Thanks for coming on.
What's your background before you became the mastermind behind Colossal? Who were you?
Oh, sure. I'm a native Texan. I grew up in Central Texas, kind of in a rural area outside of Austin, and kind of grew up with super creative, fun parents. My dad was director of design at a couple different like ad agencies, and then went in to become an art professor, and now is a bookmaker, creates limited edition like art books. My mom was a crafter and also elementary school teacher, so we had a sewing room on the second floor of our house, and I kind of grew up playing with my like G.I. Joes and my Legos with like scraps of cloth as she was like working at the sewing machine. And it wasn't long before I was like making my own crafts. You know, she would be like making my shorts for school, and I was like doing like learning how to make like a latch hook quilt. Is that what that's called? Latch hook quilt or latch hook? Like, I don't know. It's like this grid where you pull these pieces. It's really infuriating. I did like a lot of half latch hooks. And before long, I joined her. We actually had a craft booth at this place called Wimberley Market Days. And I would sell my little crafts along with her crafts and my grandmother's crafts. This is all to say, people who, if you follow Colossal, You know, it's a very broad scope of the things that we cover, from painting to sculpture to animation. But there is a very strong undercurrent of handmade, a lot of embroidery, knitting, yarn, quilts, that sort of thing. And that's just literally where it kind of all started, was being surrounded in this creative environment, you know, making things, creating things, something that I don't do now, you know, creatively or professionally. Now it's all writing and curation and that sort of thing. But yeah, when you're seeing things pop up, those are sort of like the roots or the seeds of kind of where that came from.
Hmm. So I imagine you got a sense of like aesthetics and taste from being in such a creative household early on.
Yeah, for sure. And one of my very early memories, I must have been probably 7 or 8 years old. My dad, like I said, he was a design director, and he would come home with these from photo shoots with these, what do they call, like a contact sheet of like 30 photographs. And this was actually for a publication design. It was going into like school textbooks or something. And so he would have these like 30 photographs in a huge grid and like one of those like oil markers, you know, to like make notes and like circle and cross out and whatever. So I would sit down with him as a kid. And I remember so specifically, he set one of these down in front of me one day. And it was like, I don't know, it was ridiculous. It was like three clowns, like sitting on like a colorful cube or something for like a math, you know, textbook or something. And he was like, well, which one of these is the best? And I looked at it. And just as a kid, every single photo had three clowns. They were all sitting on a box. And I was like, Dad, this is the same. Like, it's just the same photograph, like 30 times. And he, you know, kind of, you know, this is his work. He'd just been art directing this thing for, you know, I'm sure like a week. And he made me sit down and look at each photograph and tell, you know, where is their hand? Where is the shadow? Where is the light? And just something clicked in me in that moment. And clearly it stuck with me ever since, of this idea of sort of curating and like locating, like, you know, aesthetically, what's different? What works here? What doesn't work? Wow. And we kind of went through 30, you know, horrific clown photos, and you know, after an hour, we had a winner. But
wow, that's so cool!
One of your earliest memories is actually of your first curatorial moment.
Yeah, for sure. It's just sort of become embedded in me. You know, I eventually went to school for web internet kind of design at Columbia College here in Chicago. And, you know, took a lot of art classes, there's typography and drawing and painting and that sort of thing. And I realized very quickly in art school that I could become technically proficient at things, but I could not wait to do the like portfolio review at the end. All I wanted to do was to get to the part where we put everyone's drawing up, you know, everyone's like life drawing up on the wall, and then like just talk about them. And I didn't even care about my work. I was like dreading that we were going to talk about mine. I didn't care, like, you know, about, you know, being the best or whatnot. I just wanted to have that conversation around, you know, we all just drew this person, and let's look at all 20 different perspectives. And then, you know, my mind, I'm like, I'm going to figure out, you know, who's the best.
It's such a great story. And I guess it really leads to what you eventually did, you know, like all these little pieces. So how did you get involved in starting Colossal?
Well, after school, I went into creative writing as well. And sort of ended up with this weird dual, like, design and like writing degree. I was to this day, I don't know why I did this, but my sophomore year of college, I thought, I really want to get a job doing the things that I'm learning in school. And I put together a resume. I had been doing some freelance graphic design on the side. And I remember faxing applications to job open. Again, I should have been doing this my senior year, like after I've graduated. And I somehow managed to get a job at a little mom and pop advertising agency and started working full time doing graphic and web work while I was also learning it in school. Schoolwork became really boring because the pace of working at an actual agency and, like, you know, things are really on the line there. I decided to sort of switch my major into creative writing so that school would remain, you know, interesting. When I graduated, I moved on from the ad agency, and I somehow ended up, it's just smack dab in the heart of corporate America. I took a job working for a financial institution, working in a cubicle. I had to wear, you know, a tie and have a badge, and I got what I thought was like a good paycheck, and I suddenly found myself completely isolated. I had no design peers. I had no art peers. I was the only creative in about 300 people, and I would spend enormous amounts of time working on a project, working on fonts and color and doing research. And I would present it to, you know, the staff, and they would go, "Oh my God, this is incredible. Like, we're going to move forward with this logo. We're going to move forward with this website design. We're, you know, we're so grateful. Like, we've never had anything like this, you know, internally before." And after a year or two, I realized I could spend 10 minutes on a project and I could put it in front of them and they would say, "Oh my gosh, this is amazing. We're going to move forward with this. No questions asked." And I had come from a really creative background, and I just knew this was not going to be the future for me. I was very grateful to have the job, and I was very lucky, but my soul was not being fulfilled. And I made a creative challenge for myself one fall. We bought our first little condo in the city. I'd had a son, and the pressure to have a job and to be able to support myself, my family. I was like, this is really the wrong time to have a crisis. And I created sort of this creative challenge for myself, which is I started this bucket list of 100 sort of creative things that I was going to do in the next year. So I made this list in 2009. It was 100 things. I tacked it up to my closet wall. And over 2010, I took a kayaking lesson. I took a ceramics class. I picked up a guitar for like a week. I read a bunch of like creative books. Like, what's the big one? The Artist's Way, or like the, is that the one?
That is the one. I actually read it this year, and I have such a ton of problems with it that, like, okay, it's like everyone's favorite creativity book. Yeah. You know what my problem with that book is that it kind of came up with this concept of morning pages, which I think people love, and it gets people to just like wake up and do something creative first thing, and it's great. And then all the rest of it is about like nurturing. It assumes that the creative part of you is a child, is like a really like an immature, innocent person. It's like you have to nurture your innocent art child, and you have to feed your innocent art child. And after like 20 pages of this, I was like, stop being so condescending. Like, the creative part of us isn't is the part that needs to be babied, isn't the part that needs to be treated like, you know, everyone's creative. You know, everyone's creative as a kid, right? I think being creative as an adult is such a different thing and requires so much more consciousness and being able to like kind of step up and be like, all right, I still want this, rather than trying to kind of infantilize yourself and go back to this period where you were maybe this innocent creative being. I don't know. I'm sorry. That was a rant. I've been having an argument with the author of that book for like in my head for several months.
In your head?
Yes, in my head, obviously.
What
did you think?
I don't think I made it very far. I think I got it. I got to realizing the getting to like the morning pages step, and it suddenly felt like this subtask on my list of creative things that I was trying to do, that it was sort of like, I don't know, it was just like, oh, it was just like more work in ways. And I don't know, I sort of realized that, you know, and maybe it wasn't even encountering that book, that I enjoy so thoroughly being around creative people and hearing their ideas and identifying parts of myself in them, just as anyone, you know, who goes through a museum and looks at work, you know, might not be a painter, but you recognize so much about yourself but through what you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I had taken art classes in art school. I was not here to find my inner painter, my inner sculptor. That just wasn't going to happen. And sometime in the fall of that year, it was down in the 70s on this list of, you know, I really was knocking these things off of this list. I got to one and it said, start a blog. And I thought, now I have to do this. Like, it was very like, what does this even mean? This sounds like a lot of work. I don't know why I originally put this on here. But I had a graphic and web design background. I knew how to create a site that looked, you know, professional and not like a template. And I started putting this idea together and I thought up, you know, of this really optimistic title, Colossal. It was going to be like, I don't know what. It was just optimism, really, that this was going to be a big deal. And I told myself that I could just post two or three interesting things that I discovered online or had seen at a gallery or whatnot. If I could do this for about a month, that would meet the requirement for this item on my creative list. I would check it off. I would delete the website and move on to like the next creative task for that year. And like just the whim of writing, start a blog on this list, fundamentally, I mean, it changed the course of my life forever. It's changed many things for many people over the years. But I found that once I started, I absolutely could not stop publishing. I couldn't. The more I explored, the more that I found. And, you know, the early days of the site, thank God, they're not even online. I've deleted about 3 years of the first couple years of the site. Very sort of naive, you know, discoverings of really probably very famous, very well-known, super creative people who were new to me personally and sort of like presenting them like, this is my great discovery. I found out there's this show at the Guggenheim. You might have heard of this place. And, you know, gradually over the years, the site sort of became really an education for me. I was discovering processes that I didn't really know, artists that I didn't really know, movements that I didn't really know, and trying to figure out how to write about them and communicate them. And it just so happened to be, you know, this is around 2010. It was the birth of really of social media. So we were on Twitter first, and we were on Instagram first, and we were on Facebook first, and really sort of filled this vacuum of where there really weren't a whole lot of art, big art publications at the time. And the site just sort of exploded beyond anything that I ever anticipated and just took off to the tune of, you know, millions of readers within a couple of years. And I've been doing it ever since.
So that is so cool. So like I said before offline, at the time you're talking about, I didn't have internet or smartphone or anything probably till 2014, I think. And even then I never had like Facebook or any of that stuff. So I'm definitely not intelligent about what you're talking about. But you started this, as I understand, all through just your taste. You were just photographing things you liked or whatever and writing about it. And it found an audience just off your aesthetics. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it is. It was amazing. Sort of finding this maybe talent that was dormant inside of me that I had never had an outlet for. Clearly, there were so many, I can't deny, there were so many steps along the way. There were so many teachers, and my parents, of this, you know, even just that story about my dad. There were so many different aspects and things that were influencing me at the time. But yeah, it was sort of just discovering, you know, my taste and also you know, fairly early on, it became a conversation, as anyone knows who is publishing work on the internet, but be it on social media, on your website, through your newsletters, you know, the feedback that you get for many of us influences some of our next steps, whether that's consciously or subconsciously. So, you know, as I learned about things that, you know, might go viral, I would think about that a little bit. You know, we can't, you know, we never have really gone to the like level of like clickbait or, you know, trying to like game the algorithm or whatnot. But sometimes we're very surprised to find out about something that is really exciting to a broad swath of folks. And we think about it for a minute and we say, you know, are we going to let this impact our future curatorial decisions? Or is this just like a one-off like viral video or image that doesn't really have that much sort of weight to it? So through kind of making these decisions, the site sort of grew up in conversation with our audience, whether they're even aware of it or not.
So how did that feel for you emotionally? I would imagine it would kind of recalibrate your feeling of your place in the world when you wrote on your wall a list, you know, number 76, start a blog, and then all of a sudden millions of people are looking at it. Like, what did that feel like?
Hold on. I have some questions. It will get to Marshall's too, but did you ever get to number 77 or like with 76 that you're like, all right, like I found the thing.
Yeah. I finished the list. I did. It was something that the blog, you know, from the moment it went live, I honestly compare it to having a kid. This little bit of awareness switched on in my head. You know, I am absolutely always aware of my son. You know, I know where he is at school. I know what he's doing. I'm worried about him. I love it. You know, it's always there. It's there when you wake up in the morning. It's there when you go to sleep. And Colossal, similarly, it just sort of switched on this like part of my brain. And for better or worse, and sometimes it's a lot worse, you can't sort of let it go completely. It's always sort of there. You know, I'm sure a business owner could probably relate to that, or anyone who has an artistic practice where their, you know, work is, their livelihood is completely dependent on your work. It's always just sort of running and you can never fully kind of step away from it. So there is that weird, you know, yes, I don't work a traditional 9-to-5 job where I'm reporting to someone or have to meet some sort of, you know, metric or whatnot. But at the same time, it just doesn't stop. It's just this energy that's sitting there, sort of sucking your attention and your worries and your concern. But I've, you know, felt that from just the moment, you know, I hit publish, basically.
Back to what Marshall was saying, did it kind of emotionally impact, like all of a sudden you became a gatekeeper, like you became a tastemaker and a gatekeeper because thing got, and I remember when it got really big, because I'm not a reader of blogs generally, and Colossal was one of like the three art things that kind of crossed the barrier into like the internet world, my internet world, and I loved it. And I remember, like, I discovered you because you featured me at some point. And thank you, because for me it was a huge deal, right? Like, and I had people reach out, and like in a way, it kind of directed the course of my career a little bit too. Because I remember when that happened, and I remember the feeling of, oh, there's people interested in this little niche miniature thing I do, who are not just me, because things to a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
But what did it feel like becoming the person that could do that for people like me and, you know, like a lot of us?
It was horrifying. it was not horrifying. It was really scary. It was scary suddenly to be in this spot. And I knew sort of inherently that, and this is reflected even today in the way we approach things and Colossal's identity. I don't talk too much publicly. When you think of Colossal, hopefully you don't think of me. The focus has always been on the artists, and a lot of, you know, I look at our identity, not even necessarily as me, not as the people who are behind the scenes doing the writing and editing, although we love to give credit to everyone. I mean, read any Colossal article and you're going to see who wrote it, and every artist is linked and their gallery is linked, and we want to make sure that everyone, we're able to share the love with everyone. But for me, yeah, it was scary. And at the same time, it was just so energizing because I was like, I don't know, it was like writing the next, you know, episode to a TV show, or like trying to find the next chapter in a book. I was just so excited. You know, there was this like, if you like this, you know, if you like this artist, I, you know, can't wait. And it becomes sort of becomes a challenge, not the least of which it's called Colossal. So you have this, you're kind of raising the bar constantly and trying to find something else that's more interesting or unique or unusual. And, you know, in that regard, we're a very non-traditional publication. We do a lot of sort of offbeat stories. We're trying to find, I'm not interested in the commercial art world. I don't really go to art fairs. I don't really particularly find them interesting. So when you're reading Colossal, it's very sort of democratic. You're going to find, you know, a huge artist who's just had, you know, a major exhibition that we feel, you know, is extremely important, like Kehinde Wiley or something. And then the next article could be a high school photographer who took this amazing photograph that we think is really, really important and also deserves to be in this space. So in regards to like, you know, are we, is this an art publication or is this a creative publication that's more about human creativity? And then even there, we're so interested in the natural world and in nature and just the beauty of animals and plants. So it's this really strange kind of mix of disciplines and artists and mediums. And, you know, over the years, you know, for me, I look back on sort of, you know, and it's not about me, but I look at all of the, you know, editorial decisions that we've made. And I see, especially in the earlier years, I see my values sort of reflected back onto the site through the curation. And as we brought in more editors and more writers, I see their values sort of being, and I think hopefully that's how any publication should work, where everyone is sort of pitching ideas. And it's just a really beautiful way of kind of communicating with the world that I think has resonated with a lot of people.
So it was the time that you hit where, you know, before that, everything was all print media, like art magazines and things like this. And then it's like the power dynamic shifted a little bit to where someone like you could gain a huge audience and platform all these artists. And do you see that changing now? How long do you think that that specific way of when Colossal started stayed in that way as like blog that people would visit? How have things changed? Where do you see them heading?
Yeah, it's a very different world now than it was then in 2010. I will say that the year the site launched, there were articles in Wired magazine and I'm sure the New York Times or whatever talking about how blogging is dead. Like that was already over. Like, and that was I was like, this is the perfect time to start an internet publication. We'd all been talking about blogging for 10 years at that point, and everyone just assumed that it was over. Unfortunately, for many, many publications, that was the case. And I've seen them, many big publishers in our space and not in our space, come and go. Really big ones that I've loved that have just sort of collapsed, and you're just sort of shocked and you're concerned about what that means, you know, for us. We certainly took advantage for many years of sort of growing with social media and kind of maybe focusing on those individual platforms, maybe a little too much, if I were to be totally honest, maybe outweighing the importance of a social media platform versus our own publication, our own sort of audience. There are platforms that we have abandoned completely. I think our last tweet was last December. We decided this isn't a space for us anymore. We have a sizable audience there, but we looked at our relative like metrics and how many people were actually seeing the things we were tweeting about, and we decided it was just negligible and that it was more important for our voice to be elsewhere. So we've looked for other places of growth instead of that platform. And I'm not going to, everybody knows, we don't have to get into.
No. We can actually, by the way, so last December, I went to Mexico City for a week, got COVID, but before I got COVID, partially like what I do when I'm on vacation with no children is I draw a lot, like I draw outside a lot. And then I try to figure out social media algorithms because that's my weird hobby. And so the two for that week were TikTok and Twitter. And TikTok was this beautiful, shiny algorithm. And within a week, I was like, all right, I kind of like know what to do on this. I'm not sure if that's a good use of my time, but it was a beautiful algorithm. With Twitter, it's the last of the old school algorithms, which it's based on being there all the time, engaging with people. Within like 3 days on Twitter, I was like, oh, I know how this works. And it's terrible because you have to be there all the time. Like you have to be there like responding to people. And basically the people that have a huge audience on Twitter are the people who are on Twitter all day long, which sounds like the worst way to spend your time ever responding to other people on Twitter. So my first tweet was probably about last December. And my last tweet was at the end of last December. I was like, all right, I think I'm done. If a social media platform makes you need to be there more than like 20 minutes a day, that's way too much. I think you made the right shot. Like you don't want to be on this thing all day long.
Yeah. And there's just only so much time in the day. I wish that we had the time to better engage with our audience to a degree on some of these platforms, but we really don't. We use a lot of more as, you know, syndication to talk about the articles that we write, the projects that we're working on. And we try to have those conversations where we can, but the focus really comes back to the publication itself, to the articles that we're publishing. And, you know, in that regard, we've really started to think of Colossal more as an educational publication than anything. That sort of has become our primary, you know, lens to look at everything through. And it's less about, you know, trying to meet certain sort of analytics, and it's less about we are the least analytics driven publication you could imagine. We're very excited to see, you know, a large follower number or a number go up, or, you know, a video, you know, or a reel go viral. And it's really cool and it's really exciting, but it absolutely does not impact us. Almost doesn't even impact us financially. It's we're much more interested about taking the time and investing our energy and money in the quality of our writing and making sure that we're speaking to artists and that their voice appears in every piece that we write, or almost every piece that we write. And that sort of has been our focus. And social media has just gradually and then more swiftly lately taken a further and further backseat to our publication.
Do you think that is specific to you, or do you think across platforms, a lot of people are retreating from social media somewhat? Do you see it as a trend or something that you're doing?
I don't know if I can say that something is a trend or not. I can look out at artists that I talk to and friends and colleagues, you know, in the industry. And I see a general broad retreat. A lot of folks have abandoned a lot of different platforms. They've looked for alternatives. We are really enjoying Mastodon right now and have been posting there very regularly and have found a lot of engagement with readers who are probably, honestly, are probably just leaving Twitter behind. But the main focus for us is owning our content. That means publishing on our site as the kind of core operation of what we're doing, and having access to our own audience. And to that, you know, it's really newsletters. And that's where we've seen the absolute most growth in Colossal, is through all the newsletters that we publish. We see the most response from our subscribers and our readers. It's where we have all of our interactions. So that really has been our just primary form of growth and energy, is connecting with our audience directly through email, which is like, now this is like really full circle. This is like 1990s, you know, the newsletter, but it's just, you know, it's timeless. It's a wonderful medium. We get to control what we say. There's very little sort of algorithm, you know, to mess around with, or to have to feel that you have to reconfigure your approach and use certain images and that sort of thing. So that's really been our focus lately.
That's great. It sounds like you're really slowing things down back to a place where you could actually absorb information and appreciate what the readers can appreciate what they're looking at. What types of things do you look for in an artist to feature?
Oh, geez. That's actually a really hard question. That's a really hard question to answer. I don't think I could give you a list, because everything we talk about is just, it's so hugely broad. I think that one of the big discerning factors lately is it's become very easy to look at work and look at something and say, wow, this piece, whether the artist knows they're doing it or not, and you know, that's its own conversation, but to look at work and say, this was created for an algorithm. This was created, you know, the intents and purposes of this work was to be shared on the internet. And there are many wonderful things that can still go viral that have very deep meaning and deep impact. But to look at that and judge it, and you know, for us, oftentimes, you know, I look at an artwork and I say, well, first of all, what's the story behind this? Why does this piece exist? How did it come into existence? How many other people does this work impact? Does it help anybody? Does it tell me a story that I wasn't familiar with? Is it made in collaboration with a community or volunteers? And when we start checking off a lot of boxes, it very frequently ends up there's more people that are involved, that there's, you know, maybe an artist is doing a fundraiser. There's so many different, you know, things that kind of play into my own, like, brain algorithm. But, you know, we're really looking for depth, I think, is just what it is. And our audience absolutely resonates with that as far as the feedback that we get. And it's, you know, we have flirted with, I think we've done maybe 3 articles in the past 6 months, where usually it was an artist maybe that we've written about before, or one that we were familiar with, who has decided to use AI to generate some new images of, you know, and then, you know, so much of what you see that's AI generated, it's very provocative, it's very unusual, it's very science fiction-y. It's very easy to spot now, at least for me. And we've published these pieces, and I'm like, you know, I don't know why. Like, I don't know why we're publishing this. And it's interesting to see that a computer can spit out this image. And the blowback from our audience was so swift and so angry. And this is not Colossal. This is not what this publication, you know, they're telling us this. This is not what you're about. This is not what I expect to see on this website. And you know, I thought, wow, they're really right in a way. You know, these are interesting tools. I don't know where they're going. Half the time, I'm terrified of them. You know, maybe they have some practical uses in like exploration or, you know, ideation or sketching or that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, when I get, you know, an AI image in front of me, sorry, this is sort of a tangent, but it's what everyone's talking. I think you're probably talking about it on your last Art Grind podcast, I'm sure. But when I see this image, it just has no depth. It doesn't involve anyone. It doesn't involve any community. The person who is the subject of this image is nobody. You know, honestly.
You know what, Christopher? We've managed to avoid talking about AI on this podcast, but maybe we should talk about that, because it's something that, I mean, I think we didn't just avoid it because we hate it, right? I actually think it's really interesting, but it's not like a lot of people are terrified of it. I actually think it's such a separate thing from what we value in art. Like, it might be valuable in a totally different way. It might be interesting in a totally different way. It might have its own rules that it follows that are fascinating to like watch evolve. But in a way, like, it's so different from anything that I consider art, that it doesn't even scare me. I didn't even bother thinking about it that much. I was like, you know, you can tell when something is done by an AI immediately, right? Like visually, like I can show you something human and something done by an AI, and you wouldn't even have to think about it. But what are your thoughts?
I am not an expert. I will be very honest. I have never used an AI platform or chat GPT. I've never, you know, I don't know how these tools work. But at the same time, I feel sort of in the same way that, you know, we've never mentioned NFTs on Colossal before, that maybe the jury is sort of still out on what's going to happen with these tools, whether they're good, they're bad, how they're going to impact us. But I think we have made an editorial decision that for right now, they're just not for us. It's just not the direction that we want to take our publication. So much of what we like to talk about and feature on the site, with the exception of some sort of digital projects that are interesting, animation, certainly being one of them, almost everything that appears on Colossal exists in real life somewhere. This is a mural that is on this wall in this city. This is a painting that was painted by a certain artist in a certain time. It has a story and a history and a provenance. And, you know, all of those threads of meaning and history, whether the history is just brand new, whether it's just a new artist who's starting out and creating something new, create something tangible and human. And I think that's what our readership comes to, you know, to Colossal for. And I think we're going to sort of uphold those values right now. I don't know where AI is going. I've had many conversations with folks who are much, much, much smarter than me, who have talked me off the ledge of being terrified, who have talked me off the ledge of, you know, entire industries being destroyed by them. But I just know that you probably aren't going to see it on Colossal in the near future.
Do you think industries will be destroyed by it, or do you think that it'll exist as a separate? I don't think art is going to be destroyed by it. I think what we value in art and the interesting things, like the interesting, cool, fascinating things about AI, are just too, like, it's like apples and oranges. Like the oranges will keep existing somewhere over there doing their orangey things.
You know, it's interesting. I was having a conversation I was actually in Mexico recently. It was in Oaxaca, and AI came up with in a group of really, really cool, amazing designers and thinkers and artists from here in Chicago. And one of the things that we were talking about was, you know, what are the threats of AI to, you know, say a photographer whose work is primarily photographs that they upload to be licensed, like in mass, you know, thousands of photographs, you know, just sort of they make a living off of just these simple images, and AI can really kind of do that in a way of creating just a simple still life, a train, an object, that sort of thing. I feel like those sorts of jobs could potentially be threatened. If your job is to write sort of, you know, more simplistic, boilerplate, you know, corporate speak types of writing, those types of jobs, I think, could potentially be threatened. But, you know, do I think art is going to be threatened? No, I don't. What I do see happening, though, and this is a whole other thing, is that I do see AI dominating algorithms, if that makes any sense. I see algorithms like, whatever, Instagram Reels, potentially being more interested in these sort of, you know, AI generated weird, unusual types of just content. I mean, it's just content to me. It's not even, I don't know what it is. And, you know, potentially further drowning out and potentially devaluing what an algorithm is for an artist who's trying to make a living and trying to be heard. I think that's a real potential.
Well, that leads me to kind of an interesting vein to mine a little bit. I wanted to know your thoughts on what you think an image generated for an algorithm looks like. Because you said that's one thing that you've been trying to stay away from. And I would wonder what those signposts are, and then of course what AI would look for. My first question is, what does that look like? And maybe it's a little hard to put your finger on in words, I'm sure, if we showed images, but what types of things do you see about a certain artwork that look like they were made for an algorithm?
Well, first off, I wouldn't call them an artwork. an image, an image perhaps that's been generated. I don't know. They can do anything. They can create any sort of scenario with any number of people or objects or colors or whatnot. Well, one of the issues, this is a little bit of a tangent, we can go back to the main one. One of the issues that we have had and that artists have brought to our attention is that in some of these AI generated images of, perhaps portraits or paintings or in the, you can sort of, I think you can type like in the style of, Van Gogh or whatever it is. And you sort of see these little squiggles down in the corner of the image in some of these AI generated, pieces. And it's a signature. And it's trying to generate that signature from the very real, very human signatures of all the like 8 million, actual paintings that went in to train this algorithm. And to me, I find that super problematic. This is like the very physical thing, actual evidence fingerprint of these artists' work being used to sort of create without authorization to create this brain. And the creators of these algorithms or these AI tools like to say that, well, these images aren't in like, it's not like a database, right? There's not like a database where we have all these images of this artist and this artist. It just, they're not actually in there, but the algorithm or the AI generating tool did get to look at them, did get to see them, did get to think about them, did get to, so whatever code speak you would, again, I'm not an expert here. So when I see this, again, I just feel like it's just like everything and nothing all at once.
Have you ever read it's a Robert Sheckley story, maybe like a short novel. It's called Can You Feel Anything When I Do This? It's about a man who buys vacuum cleaner, or it's like in some future where AI and all of that exists. And the vacuum cleaner, I think, basically tries to seduce him. It has all of these functions programmed into it. And at some point, the vacuum cleaner, but like she, they call her she, is like, oh, and do you want me to cook for you as well? Because like one of my functions is like, I can, tell me what meals you like. Do you want me to massage your feet? and I think that, this is now that I think about it, a pretty obscure sci-fi writer who mostly published in Playboy and was mostly popular in Eastern Europe, which is why no one in the US actually reads them. But I think at the end where, I think he begins falling in love with the vacuum cleaner machine, and it tells him that she was actually the one that fell in love with him and in the store, like she picked him out, and he didn't buy her for no reason, like she had this whole plan from the get-go. But whenever I look at AI, I kind of think of that, it's like, can you feel anything when I do this? And I'm like, I don't feel it, like
you,
I don't
feel it, yeah,
like, feel anything when I create this Dali like painting, like, no, I don't. Like can you feel anything in the style of Rubens? Like, I don't. Mm-hmm.
Can I just interject? I'm sure there are many people who listen to this, clearly who listen to this podcast regularly, and I've listened to a couple of episodes prior to coming on here, and your ability to think of the perfect short story that represents the current topic at hand is incredible. You could almost have a separate resource guide to the short stories mentioned in this episode. It would be wonderful.
Oh, there's probably an AI that could do that.
An AI that could figure it all out for us.
I should probably, every time I keep sometimes I listen to these episodes. Like, I actually listened to the one with Lorraine Lutz recently, and I do that. And I was like, I shouldn't do that. Like, I shouldn't just keep mentioning obscure books, but then I feel like so much of my brain is like, so much of the ways that I see the world is kind of led through the things that I've read that have gone into me, that it's really hard not to.
Well, I want to get to that idea though, that these things are changing us as we're inventing them. And at this point, back to what you said earlier, like, you know, when a human is making an artwork that's there to satisfy some algorithm and get pushed through and go viral. And Dina's really good with algorithms, obviously. What, this is a question for both of you guys. What does that look like? What does a human make, like, how is it changing the way that we're doing art?
Sure. You know, on that note, I feel more so than just identifying a particular artwork that might be based on a meme or that might be based on a trend that's going around, perhaps on TikTok, perhaps on Instagram or some other type of platform. And I know that you've talked about this on previous episodes, so we don't have to go into it too much. But what I do identify with is sort of all of the extra steps, all the extra work, all the extra like marketing and sort of like gimmicky, like, how do I have to record this video in just a certain like way? As far, you know, and I love watching process videos. We share them all the time. But I also feel so like, I almost feel like sorry for the artists, just the burden of the work, the extra work that they have to do on top of being creative, on top of being a human in the world who, you know, has responsibilities and kids and a life, you know, off of social media, but just all of these additional layers that they have to deal with in order just to get a 2D image seen by a large audience so that they can grow their audience, sell work, land in a show, that sort of thing. I don't know what the solution is. I don't know what the answer is. I'm not somebody who has all these like plans, but I find it really sort of disheartening. And what I sort of do at the end of the day is just disengage from it. And I'm like, I just need to find another outlet. I need to find another way to engage with artists that's separate from this, be it offline, be it through, you know, curating exhibitions and just having shows in real life. You know, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but I sort of feel like there's going to be an upheaval in the next couple of years. Like, there's only so much further we can go. There's only so much more time that we have. There's only so much faster we can go before it's just not sustainable anymore.
But so what you're talking about, though, is basically the work that real artists who spent their life learning how to make art, whatever kind of art there is, and now all of a sudden they have to become like a creator of short form videos. And those are like most of the Instagram people that I teach. Like, they're people who make frequently better art than I do and have had like more real, I feel like more real careers than I have. And now they're kind of like stuck trying to basically show the real work that they do in a way that appeals to the algorithm, right? But I feel like that's one problem. And the problem Marshall was, and maybe you were talking about earlier, is so there's presenting your own work in a way that like fits whatever social media platform you're using, right? And then there's people who actually have started making work just for the algorithm. And that's kind of like a different problem, because those are, you know, and I think that's what you mentioned earlier, and that might have been, Marshall, is that what you were asking about?
Yeah, 100%. In your answer last time, you sort of said memes. Is that like an indicator if they're very online and putting like, I don't know, that little green frog or whatever in their artwork? Is it like that sort of like little landmarks? Or I know for myself,
right.
I grew up painting nudes in people's studios, you know, just like we trained that way. And it was this really beautiful thing. And algorithms don't like that. And nudes have all but disappeared from art, you know, because it's been censored out of it. And if you're doing them, they're not getting seen. So I'm wondering what the reverse of that kind of, what is getting seen, you know, because of algorithms, because of the way that it's changing the way we're painting.
I see a couple of different things, but it is apparent to me when a work has depth and when a work is more perhaps shallow, and when an artist is sort of creating. Now, you know, Andy Warhol was making things super quickly that were probably based on, you know, trends of pop art at the time. So maybe it's just the same thing and I'm an idiot and I don't, you know, see the long-term depth, you know, in creating works that are existing inside of an algorithm, you know, for the sake of being, for the sake of being seen. But to me, it is apparent when I'm looking at something and I can just sense, and I can't tell you visually what it is. It's a feeling. It's an emotion. You know, curating is an emotional thing. It's a cerebral thing. And I can just sense when an artwork is being created to satisfy like arbitrary algorithmic criteria versus something that is deeply human, deeply personal, deeply rooted in the identity of who that person is. To me, it's like night and day when I see those two images next to each other, no matter what the work is. I don't know if I can give you a better answer than that, but it is, it's human. It's just a human sort of, the impulses are more emotion. They draw from history, from personal experience. And then on the other hand, you just have work that just seems more shallow. It's work that seems like in 6 months it's dated somehow already. Like how they just made this 6 months ago and it feels like it was made just for 6 months ago and now doesn't seem to particularly have any relevance.
You know, so I have a sister who's a painter. She's an amazing painter, right? And I think I, for various reasons, like, I don't know, maybe either life or personality wise, I always have engaged with these algorithms. And like, there's a part of me that's probably a little deformed where like sometimes I look at an artist's work and I was like, this is really good. And here would be a way to photograph it. So, photograph it so it goes viral, right? So my sister's always like refused to have anything to do with any of this. And she had a show open about 2 weeks ago in New York of work that she's never shown anyone. She's did it just for herself over the course of 5 years. And she spent 5 years making these 10 paintings that she didn't bother promoting, don't translate well to social media, and are like the most amazing things that I've, you know, ever seen. Like as far as I'm concerned, my sister's show, in case by the time we edit this, by the way, her show is still up. Everyone should go see it. It's in Tribeca. I'm not just saying it because she's my sister, but I wonder if she couldn't have done what she did. Paintings are like, they're real art, right? My take on it is always like, oh, just do what you do and you can present it and, you know, you can like tweak the presentation that's going to go viral. But I'm wondering if she couldn't have done what she did if she had to say bad algorithms, like if it wouldn't have been.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that happens to us every single day through the work that is submitted to us through, you know, things that artists are creating, they want us to be aware of. They have an opening, you know, a new show, and we're reviewing the press release and whatnot. And, you know, I can admit our human curation, it has its own, of course, has its own bias. And maybe our bias is no better than a necessarily an algorithm, because I'm always asking myself, does this work present itself in a way that's simple enough to understand on this website, in this blog, at this time? And yeah, there are a lot of artworks. Clearly, we've written about, you know, 5,000-6,000 artists at this point. There's a lot of work that fits that criteria. And there is incredible stuff that comes to us every single day that exists in a format, in a space, in a place and time that's not right for us, but it's right for somewhere else. So I really hate this, like, it's not a mantle, but it's sort of this, like, you know, there are people who submit work to us that very, very much want to have their work seen on Colossal specifically. And I might even absolutely love their work back. But I know that it just doesn't translate into this particular space. It belongs somewhere else. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but, you know, we're just one platform. We're one voice out of so many other places. And there's like, yeah, this is our little, you know, this is our own little ecosystem. This is our own little world that we've sort of created here. But it's, you know, there's a very vast, large, giant, other space out there for artwork to exist that I will never be able to see all of it or experience all of it. But, you know, to the point of your sister's show is still hugely successful and wonderful and unique and beautiful and has tremendous value.
By the way, I'm assuming that you get like 100 submissions a day. Like, is that what you wake up to in the morning? And then part of your job is to be like, all right, you sort it into the pile of things that definitely don't work, you know, things that probably don't work, and maybe the two have a chance. Is that the...
Yeah, it's, you know, I would say the first 3 to 4 hours of every day is looking at work. We probably get 30 to 40 emails a day. If I were to include Instagram messages, that's another 100 a day. We have artists that we're keeping up with who are sending stuff to me personally. There is, I'm a big fan of RSS. Still read a lot of blogs. I probably read about 100 publications. I read everything, at least glance at everything that goes up, so I can have an idea of like what's happening, what are things that everyone's talking about, what's floating around out there. And you know, I don't know how much I look at, but I would say for me, it's probably out of about 1,000 projects in the course of the morning, we'll pick out 3, and those will be the 3 that we go with. They're the staff also. We have kind of an internal submissions process, and a lot of those pieces end up on the site just by nature of we've all been writing here and we all know kind of what the ethos of the site is, and we're able to kind of select things and sort of pick them out. And yeah, and there's, I don't know, I honestly, my mom emails me and I'm like, yeah, mom, this is great. I don't know, you know, I don't know where you found this, but this is a great artist. We're totally gonna, you know, it comes from everywhere.
So what are the current projects that you've got going on? Because you also, like, you curated a show a few months ago. I think you've got more on your plate. So you've got Colossal and the colossal amount of stuff that comes with that, but you've got a lot of other things that you do. So can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I'm super excited. I've actually got the okay to specifically announce publicly 2 things on this podcast for the very first time. We haven't published them anywhere yet, but I got everybody's sort of thumbs up. Yeah, we are curating a large show here in Chicago at Design Museum of Chicago that opens in July. It's co-curated with my partner here at Colossal, Grace Ebert. The show is titled At the Precipice. And it is a group show of artists, international artists responding to the climate crisis. There's a lot of crochet and weaving and that sort of thing. We've got a lot of ceramic artists. Local Chicago artists will be there. I can't announce any names yet, but that show will open on July 14th of this year. And it's been an absolutely massive undertaking for us, and it's going to be accompanied by a film program and lots of programming and a concert. So we're super excited about that.
That's so cool.
And then also I just curated a group show at the You Are Beautiful Gallery here in Chicago. I don't know if you've ever seen those. You ever seen a You Are Beautiful sticker, the little silver stickers? They're sort of ubiquitous. They're on people's phones and they're on lampposts and yeah, they're all over the place. That's my friend, Matt Hoffman. He created 100 of those stickers about 20 years ago for a group of friends. And he just passed them out for fun. They just said, "You are beautiful." And like a couple of the friends were like, "Hey, that's a cool sticker. Can I get like a couple? Can you get me a couple more? Cause I want to put them on stuff." I don't know how many millions of stickers later we are, but it's 3, 4, 5 million. It's probably more than that at this point. And the project has just grown exponentially to the point of where You Are Beautiful is so big that Matt doesn't even lay claim to it anymore. He just says he's the custodian of it because so many people all over the world use the phrase. It's in street art, it's in murals, it's in, you know, t-shirts and that sort of thing. But they've opened a small gallery in their space here in Chicago. And I'm doing a group show there. Very not related to climate change, kind of the polar opposite. It's called Drip Drop Slice. And it has very colorful, poppy, drippy, abstract, really bright artworks. Again, a lot of ceramics and fabric and paper and that sort of thing. And that opens April 15th.
That's so cool. So you're bringing... You're really like continuing to bring your taste out there, even though it feels like in a way the idea of social media and stuff is becoming less important to you, and now you're doing curation out in the real world. How does that
We've started also doing, we do have a workshop series now. We do one workshop a month. It's virtual. We partner with an artist that we love, be it an illustrator, sculptor, painter, somebody who draws, just all kinds of different folks. We've done 4 or 5 of them now. We've got 4 or 5 of them scheduled. And the more that we've done of these, the more, now that we're connecting with real people, we're connecting artists with our audience, we realize we really want this to just be happening in real life. So we also want to take this offline and start doing maybe a more educational workshop series. And we sort of are starting to feel out plans for not only how does that look locally here in Chicago, how do we bring some of these artists that you might have heard of on Colossal and connect them with a Chicago audience, but how does that look nationally? How does that look if we have partner organizations where we're working with we're having workshops across the US or perhaps internationally? So, you know, at every step, we're like, this works really well on the internet, you know. How does this work in a gallery? How does this work in a classroom? How does this work, you know, elsewhere? Colossal will publish, that's the core of what we do. I don't want to like plant these seeds of like the site is like ending, but I think we'll be publishing for another 20 years. But if we like morph into a magazine at some point and we go full circle and it, you know, we just go back to print in a couple of years, like, you know, maybe that's the direction. I don't know, but the longer I have spent on the internet, in front of my computer, emailing, publishing, the more my personal tastes have sort of gone offline and kind of back into the real world. So,
It's because everything that makes you actually happy happens in the real world. Like, there's a lot of interesting things that happen online, and even the fact that we can have this conversation, like, this wouldn't have been possible if, I don't know, you didn't find me online years ago and then I wrote you also online about something else a few years later, etc. But all of the things that, you know, like there's so much information and knowledge, and like we have to like go into the online world for money and for, you know, we go into that world for all sorts of things, but every single thing that makes us happy like happens in this world, not the metaverse.
I was talking to Grace the other day. We're pitching around this idea of an offline art exhibition. What am I even saying? But an art exhibition, but where absolutely everything took place completely devoid of the internet. There would be no email. There would be no nothing. And we were like, we've got to letterpress these invitations somewhere. And we're just going to manually, this is going to be like the 1980s. And, you know, you're like, we're just reinventing this radical new way that they did art shows, you know, 40 years ago.
All right. But the art world 40 years ago also had its problems. And like the internet, you know, it's also brought us a lot of magical things, like not having to letterpress everything and go around like
I know.
And the street posts, right? I'm sure you look at so much art online. I look at a lot of art online. It's still so much better in a gallery or a museum or an artist studio or an art school. Like I think the reason that Meta, Zuckerberg, all of that is kind of bound to fail is hopefully, like I hope he'll fail with the metaverse, right? I don't want to live in there. I don't think I would like a single person who would choose to live in that. But I think it'll fail because people don't really. And because like, you know, like you can't feel anything when you do that. And we, you know, as humans, like we want to feel things. You went from being like a corporate graphic designer to being the king of the internet. And now you're curating things at museums. Where do you think you'll go next?
Oh, yeah. You know, every time I think I know what is going to happen next, everything sort of changes. I look forward to a time, you know, perhaps we do continue publishing as we have. We keep our social media channels going as they are and are able to. One of our main drivers of support right now is membership. We switched at the beginning of the pandemic. We were a largely advertising driven publication. And in the matter of days, you know, as the world was shutting down, every single advertiser that we had for the next couple of months had canceled all of their campaigns, because everything that we, all of our big advertisers, it's stuff that happens in real life. It's exhibitions and shows and schools and like the, you know, upcoming semester and classes and continuing education. And it just vanished. Mm-hmm. And we decided, what would it look like if we became more of a reader driven publication? And that is really where we are now. We are predominantly funded by memberships and our readers. We have a couple thousand folks out there who are make sure that we're able to continue doing what we do every single day and are continue to grow and whatnot. For me personally, I'm excited for all of that. I'm excited for more workshops and all the artists that we have yet to discover. And we want to redesign. We have a big redesign coming up and new logo and identity. I continue, you know, and this is just ongoing thread of what we've been talking about. Have just continually looked at opportunities of how do we connect with our existing audience without a screen in front, you know, between us, without an algorithm between us, without a phone between us, and taking meaningful steps offline and, you know, trying to figure out how those two sort of work together. And I'm really excited. Honestly, I get excited about it. Like, I actually just get excited about it. This, you know, idea of, you know, maybe 50, 60, 70% of our work is not, you know, in front of a screen anymore. I don't know. That's what I hope for. I don't know what that looks like, but
I feel excited after talking to you about this stuff too, because it does seem like there's just a general fatigue about all the online and social media and the things that come out about, you know, the news cycle and what that does to us and what it's doing to people who are online too much, young kids and stuff. And it just feels like, I'm so happy to hear you talk about adding community and real world experiences back in as your focus is, to me, excellent.
How old is your son now?
He's 15.
You didn't grow up on the internet, but he did. What's your relationship to your son's internet use?
Yeah, at the risk of sounding super contrarian, there's probably a lot of parents who are going to have their own sort of take on this, and I, you know, to each their own. But my parenting approach is very heavily restricted. He has never been on, he's 15, he's never seen social media before. He has no social media accounts. He has no access to any of that. He does play video games. He is a digital native. He has an email account. We watch a ton of YouTube videos together. He plays Minecraft and he networks with some of his friends. But I try to shield him completely from social media specifically. I have a very negative view of it and its impact on kids and their well-being. And, you know, eventually, of course, he'll have full access to the internet. But I am I have been very sort of like focused on how to grow his brain, not on the internet, before introducing too much, before introducing too much internet to it. I want him to have social media is not reality. I understand that it is a way for him to perhaps connect with his friends in a different way, but I really encourage those connections to happen in other ways first.
You know, it's funny, and you were a person who kind of grew a business out of the internet. And honestly, like, I am too in a lot of ways. Like I do this thing with algorithms for like, you know, some part of my life. My kids are younger, so I don't know how long I can keep it up. Having seen what it does to adult brains and how much it's them, I basically like, I don't let my kids touch screens. Like we can watch like on a Saturday, and that's all they get. Like and eventually they'll discover, you know, the video game, you know, like I won't be able to keep it going for forever. But yeah, as a longer, I feel like every year I can, and I know maybe I'm crazy and also contrarian, but I feel like every year that I can keep their brains away from just screens. It's a parenting win.
Sure. there are many stories out there about folks like, Steve Jobs is an example. I have heard, I don't know if it's true, but I believe that it is. You know, his kids couldn't have phones and iPads. A lot of these people that develop these algorithms that work high up in the echelon, they know what they're doing to people's attention, what they're doing to people's mental health. And the stories of what actually goes home in the, what actually goes on in those homes where they have kids and their kids don't get to see it. They don't get to touch it. They can't be within, 100 feet of it because they know what it actually does.
You know, so my mom, like my parents help take care of my kids, and my mom's got this program called Lexia, which just, teaches little kids, my kids four, it's to, a program that teaches them to read. And every time I come pick them up and I see them on that, I don't want to mess with my mom's grandparenting, but there's a part of me, it's like, no, just we'll sit down. He'll learn how to read 2 years later, but not via a program. I'm convinced that even that thing is bad for him. Because of the interacting with the screen rather than interacting with a person.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. I think, I don't have a kid, but I totally agree with what you guys are saying. And I've certainly been someone who's stayed off of it and seen, obviously, political ramifications and all that. And I can't help but think that they're eroding our sense of what art is as well. Sort of like we were talking a little bit before about what's made for an algorithm, what an algorithm likes. It just feels so tragic that so much of our effort is trying to appease these robot overlords, like a key in a lock, And it feels so, we hold it as what humans are doing and something fairly sacred, an expression of us. And all of a sudden, there are these invaders that have nothing to do with humanity or aesthetics, like gatekeeping this stuff, which is so pervasive.
To be fair, the gatekeepers we had before this kind of suck too. So
they were human. I think that there was something nice. Look, Christopher's a human gatekeeper. He does a great job. But when it's just some Instagram algorithm, I don't love that.
I don't know, Marshall. I'd rather negotiate with an algorithm than negotiate with the guy giving out a grant at the window. who looks at my resume and is like, Dina Brodsky failed to get this or that preliminary grant and didn't get into this summer residency at Yale that she was supposed to get into. So no chance, right? At least the algorithm isn't judging you based on a set of credentials that you, are no longer capable of getting.
And I don't want to, I feel like I've been sort of purposely so, I've been sort of pessimistic, in this conversation, because that's generally where my heart is with things like social media, algorithms, AI, and that sort of thing. And while I know that they are not necessarily my preference, there are many, many wonderful things that have come about, because of social media. And I don't deny that. There are artists who have found audiences that they never would have found otherwise. They have gotten work and established careers, and they are extremely, these platforms are extremely valuable. People's entire livelihoods, are sort of based around these platforms. And to a degree, that is very beautiful. That is very empowering. It is very sort of democratic. It gives voice to people that might not have had trouble for a variety of reasons finding, an audience otherwise. But I feel that when it encroaches on our mental health, when it encroaches on our values, when we're making sort of these sacrifices in our work, in our life, and our attention, what we're looking at for hours in a day, I do see that it's problematic. And, that's just forced me to have sort of my own sort of aversion to it. And, right now, if you're still able to function in that space and you have a healthy relationship and you're able to maintain this relationship with your audience and sort of talk to people, it's beautiful, it's wonderful, and you should keep doing that. But I just know for me, and perhaps for the future of Colossal, that's going to be a little bit more regulated.
I mean, it's both. It's just as destructive as you think it is. It's helped an enormous amount of people. I guess my thing is I'm probably as pessimistic as you about social media. I just don't think that what it replaced was anything better. Like I think the human gatekeepers at the top of a lot of institutions were, if anything, harder to deal with and harder to negotiate with. And you kind of like, you needed a pedigree and you needed all of these things that, you know, with the algorithm, like at least you only need to figure out how it works at that specific moment. I just don't believe in like the fact that there was ever any good old days where like, where we can like, well, oh, that was the golden years of whatever. Like it was always hard. Like making a living as an artist was always hard. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, like, just because everyone who listens to this is an artist, do you have any advice for artists, either regarding, you know, Colossal or in case you want even more submissions, but just in general, like, because you've worked with so many artists, you've written about so many artists, do you have a word of advice after, you know, a lot of years of you doing this?
You know, we were talking about the mental health aspect of an algorithm, and also talking about gatekeepers in general. And, you know, I can't tell you how excited I am, and everyone on the staff is here at Colossal. We're always so excited to see new work, whether it works for the site, whether it doesn't. Oftentimes, an artist comes to us with 2, 3, 5, 6 projects over the course of a couple years before it finally sort of clicks. And we feel like it's right. And everybody is doing such a great job. Everyone is doing so wonderful. And your work is just as important as you think it is. And we are one platform and we're so grateful when we're able to share an artist's story. We have our own biases that we're working on ourselves. We have, you know, our own sort of constantly evolving approach to what we want to see on the site. And for me, just as a personal, like, you know, what I like to see is that sort of human connection. It's just so helpful when, you know, somebody reaches out to an editor and, you know, calls them by their name, and there's a clear, like, understanding of at least of the site and, you know, who we are. It doesn't have to be, I'm not asking for any compliments, but just like, it's just nice to, and I hate to add another level. I know you're already so busy having to fight an algorithm and send out your newsletter to actually, you know, research, you know, a publication and that sort of thing. I'm not asking you to do that, but just, you know, be yourself, be succinct, show your work, make it simple. Don't overthink it. I can say that for the most part, we don't read press releases. I know there's some people out there who probably write these things and they want them to be just beautiful and like cover every single aspect of like their work and their value and their meaning. And they're very important. And I get it, but we're looking at just hundreds and hundreds of projects a day. There isn't time to sit down and read everything. We really want to see your work. We want to hear your voice. We want to connect with you quickly and your work quickly. So, you know, whatever you can do to make that a little bit easier and a little bit more human and maybe not so robotic is helpful. And that's something that resonates with us as well.
Thank you. That was actually really helpful. No one reads press releases.
Well, I don't know. I scroll down to the bottom of the press release and I look for the link. Open the attachments. I start looking at the images. I want to see the work pretty quickly. And usually after reflecting on the work for, you know, a minute or two, I might go back to the press release to learn a little bit more. But I can say for me and probably for the rest of the staff, you're not going to convince us to write about your work with 4 paragraphs of text that we have to sit down and kind of go through. It has to be a little bit more quick. It has to be a little bit more succinct. So that's helpful.
That actually is really helpful. So I've always hated writing press releases so much that like the one thing that I would ever actually use an AI for is if I could get an AI to write my artist statement or write my press release, I would totally do that.
Right. And it would have the same effect because I would skip reading the AI press release. I would go directly to your website, your portfolio, always like hit up your Instagram and get a sense of kind of what it is that you're talking about, and then go back to the press release. That's usually the second or third thing that I'm going to pay attention to.
And by that point, you might have already made up your mind. So the AI, so the ChatGPT press release is, not going to affect your decision making.
Yeah.
Christopher, by the way, thank you so much for like just coming on and being so like generous and genuine. And like, I pick guests for this, like people I admire and who I feel like could tell a good story. And it's always a, like it's a gamble, like I've never actually talked to you, right? So I've admired you from afar. You know, we've never actually met. So you, and you're everything that I imagined and more.
Oh, thank you. That's very, it's very, very kind of you. Very sweet. Yeah. And absolutely. Likewise, I've been following your work for years. I am a subscriber of the podcast now for sure, having listened to so many episodes before coming on. So kudos to you and Marshall. And who else? There's other folks help with this as well, correct?
Tom's the producer. Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on, Christopher. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
This is great. Awesome. Well, I hope you both continue to have a wonderful day. Super honored, grateful. Thank you. Thank you for having me on. This is a really great conversation. I have actually just gave me a lot to talk about because I took notes while we were talking. I don't even know why. I was like having ideas and like you guys were saying things. So now apparently I have like a to-do list here. So it's great.
Did you put together like 100,
100? Yeah, right. No, I got to do 100 things now because of this conversation.
Well, and for me, I feel very good that you're in a part of the art world and a gatekeeper in that way, that it has a lot of real integrity behind it, and it just makes me feel very positive. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Hey, Christopher.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, our grand listeners, I just want to mention that this interview was recorded earlier this year in March. And some of the exclusive breaking news that's included in this episode are no longer exclusive, but the exhibition is still open, so I hope you get to go see it. If you enjoyed this episode and you are a visual artist, you can help us keep costs of producing the Nix podcast to zero by supporting our sponsor. Just go to professionalartist.com/free and access a free training on how to get your Nix art collector. That's professionalartist.com/free. And that link will be in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and I hope you got some good painting done while we entertain you with our amazing guest. If you like what you're hearing, follow and subscribe to our podcast if you haven't done so yet. And if you're so inclined, rate us whether you love or hate us. We love hearing all the different opinions and appreciate the feedback. You can reach out to us at artgrindpodcast@gmail.com or DM us on IG @artgrindpodcast. You faithful listeners have the power to help us grow. So please spread the word. It's free and you'll feel good about it. So until next time, stay on the grind while we fill your mind.